In October 2019, the first ever International Conference on Environmental Peacebuilding was convened by the Environmental Peacebuilding Association at the University of California at Irvine. More than 250 people from 40 countries attended, practitioners, researchers, journalists, donors, policymakers, students, and activists. You're listening to Friday Podcasts from the Wilson Center's Environmental Change and Security Program. Over the next few weeks, we'll be featuring interviews with experts, practitioners, and leaders on environmental peacebuilding captured by ECSP on the edges of the conference. I'm Lauren Reese, and in today's episode, we'll hear from Jeff DeBelko, a professor at Ohio University and senior advisor to ECSP, and Sharon Burke, senior advisor at New America, where she directs the Resource Security Group, and former Assistant Secretary of Defense for Operational Energy.
So this is Sharon Burke, and we're here at the very first Environmental Peacebuilding Conference, International Conference, being held at UC Irvine, beautiful place. And I'm sitting here with Jeff DeBelko, who is on the board of the organization and is one of the people that designed and conceived of this conference. So can you tell me, you know, I'm coming from a national security background, and finding I'm in the middle of a room where I don't totally understand what's going on and who's here. Can you tell me, like, what this organization and this conference, what you had in mind? Like, what is environmental peacebuilding, and what did you and the other board members hope to achieve by having this conference?
Well, I think the creation of the Environmental Peacebuilding Association and then the first conference of that group was designed to create a place where a where there wasn't a community, but there could be, and that some related, sometimes disparate strands of work and topics could come together and build a professional network and learn from one another in the realms of scholarship and research and discovery, as well as practice and making a difference and trying to address conditions on the ground and in communities. And so in that way, I don't think there were I think there are broad notions of inclusion, of what should be included, and not a prescribed definition of this is our environmental peacebuilding, and if you don't fit that, you're not welcome. But instead, come tell us how you see what you're working on or what you're trying to understand fits and combines issues of environment on the one hand, and issues of peace and conflict and security, both narrowly and broadly defined, and bring those together. And that's very sometimes extremely local settings, and sometimes all the way up to global, and plenty in between. And so in that respect, I think the intent is to be inclusive. Now, who actually is here and the focus of the conversations are diverse, but not in equal measure by across the different topics and ways people can come
and
to the
diversity
table.
In this case, you don't mean racial diversity or demographic diversity. You mean diversity of research and of sort of what is a peace builder, an environmental peace builder, that you have a certain, I mean, I notice a lot of scholars and also a lot of people who are working on very localized projects. And it's funny, listening to them, I'm at once sort of like really excited about what they're doing, and also, you know, really like the owl guy, you know, that's using owls to get Palestinians and Israelis together. You know, how awesome is that? But at the same time, I'm like, there's a part of me as someone who spent a lot of time in the Pentagon that's like, yeah, that's not going to do it. You know, that's a wonderful project, and what a wonderful man. He's a better person than I am, but that doesn't scale. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of my first impression when I got here, that it was a lot of people working on very discrete projects and very scholarly projects. But once I kind of got over myself and relaxed and started really talking to people, it's a really interesting cross-section. And I wonder if we can kind of carve a field or an identity, mm-hmm. a communal identity out of it. So it feels like it's the beginning of a conversation. Mm-hmm. And I definitely tried to throw some hooks into it. And the last conversation we had was late afternoon of the last day. So we didn't probably have as many people engaged. But, you know, one of the things I said is, the United States and China are on the road to war. And if you're an environmental peace builder and you're not thinking about that, you might want to. Because it's, you know, all these places that people are looking here are really important, and they're knitting, you know, they're sewing the threads together of peace. But there's a bigger picture here that's deeply troubling, and environment plays a role, and environment may play a positive role too. And I found it fascinating that you don't hear anybody here talking about that.
So let me now ask you. So while I think everyone would acknowledge that there are different levels that one can come in on, and there are different institutions, public, private, non-governmental, up to national governments and militaries. But from your perspective, if the biggest story is the new superpower competition between China and the U.S., and it seems that the only tool in the toolbox is a hammer, use of force, how is it that we need to understand the environment and environmental peace building in that context as a way to both understand that competition and what's behind it, but also understand the weaknesses, insufficiency, the misguided dimension of that being the only story?
Right. And, you know, it shouldn't be the only story. I feel like every story that's here matters in its own right. But I also really wish that the people that work in this space were cognizant of the fact that there's, you know, a potentially world war brewing. And that what worries me the most is that what I see the United States and China investing in, at least vis-a-vis each other, is, again, hostility and adversarial relationships, or at best, very competitive. And what, you know, during the Cold War, we put a whole lot of effort into, you know, confidence building measures and de-escalation measures and trying to imagine what it would look like if we weren't at war. And we're not there yet with China. So as far as the role of resources, we just put out a report looking at that for a couple of different reasons. One is, again, because, you know, like it or not, the Pentagon is the center of gravity in the U.S. government. It's overwhelmingly where the resources are. And they're well down that road, and they're all about weapons systems. And so resources are relevant to that in two ways. One, resources are going to be part of that competition, but they're really focused on weapons. And they're not looking at the fact that this is also going to be a struggle for influence and for materials. And, you know, China is thinking about that. And the data that we looked at clearly shows that, whether you're looking at, you know, cobalt and lithium, or, you know, energy and agriculture resources or land, right? They're thinking ahead. And the other piece of that that we were really interested in, well, you know, first, that as an arena of competition or potential conflict, and that a lot of these materials are really important for the modern economy, but also how is climate change going to affect that, the resource availability, the resource competition, and, you know, should climate change be considered a strategic driver in its own right in this context? You know, not just about the ways that we do think about it in security, which is it's undermining human security, and may even lead to conflict, but in this light, that it's also going to change and affect what's important to China and what's important to the United States, the world's two biggest economies. So, you know, for example, China's largely self-sufficient in agriculture. They have a couple of really important gaps. One is soy, which you got to appreciate the irony. The soybean was born in China, and it's a staple of the diet, but they only meet 13% of their own production. So, it has been the boom for our soy industry, our soy farmers. And of course, there's a little trouble on that front right now, but China's going to have to buy that soy from somewhere else. You know, they've got a lot of resources themselves, but not enough for 1.4 billion people on the land that they have. So they're going to have to continue to get resources from elsewhere. So that's part of the picture. And then when you bring in climate change, and it begins to affect production and productivity, that just ups the ante. And again, there are only so many places you can go at that point. So, and United States will be one of them. Mm-hmm. You know, I like maybe this is something I should have known, but China and the United States are about the same size, and they're both mid-latitudes, so their climates are relatively mild relative to the rest of the world, and pretty similar level of variation. They're actually really similar countries in some ways, which I just never thought about that. The biggest difference is that 330 million people live in the United States and 1.4 billion live in China. And so for them, that's a tremendous driver. And climate change will just make everything more, right? And the other side of it is that if we're going to have an energy transition, we're going to be transitioning from one mineral to another. So right now, oil has geopolitical resonance, you know, and has for 60 years. Now it's going to be critical minerals because you can't have electric vehicles without a lot of cobalt and lithium and rare earth elements. And of course, all the high tech world depends on that too. But solar panels, electric vehicles, all of that requires minerals. And I don't think we're really thinking about that at all. Certainly not in like sort of the environmental community about the fact that, you know, we do think about conflict minerals, things like that, but we don't think about the fact that we need those minerals to make an energy transition. And by the way, they have consequences too for instability, but also, I mean, what it takes to get cobalt, for example, out of a rock in a usable form is a dirty, dirty process that creates a lot of pollution. So, you know, we need to be thinking about these things with the level of challenge that's coming up. And China is thinking about it. You know, they're pretty major polluters, so I don't necessarily mean it in that way, but they're definitely thinking about the resources they need, the diversification of their suppliers, and the ways that climate change may put pressure on those relationships. The United States is not, because we have faith in the markets, and I'm not sure that that's a wise thing.
It seems to me you make a strong case for this frame being part of, having to be part of an environmental peace building frame. And it does also strike me that it suggests that we go back to what is maybe a neglected and or forgotten or never well understood history of how what we might call environmental peace building went on during the Cold War between the US and the Soviet Union. And that it may be those models that we need to make sure we're talking about today because of this competition that you're talking about. And so some of that diversified portfolio of engaging the Soviet Union, clearly pointing weapons at each other, was a big part of it. But there were questions of efforts around scientific exchange and as well as kind of that wider strategic portfolio about the battle of ideas and being attractive to the rest of the world and being engaged and having having transactional relationships, but one that was also part of higher ideals. But it does make me think of things where the military, U.S. military, was engaging other militaries around the world, even during the Cold War, in ways where environment was a means to talk and have exchange. Maybe there was an environmental end, but there definitely was a security end to that scientific exchange, often through NATO and a variety of outreach mechanisms there, sometimes strictly scientific, certainly a spike in that kind of activity as the Cold War ended, but lots of uncertainty about who was in charge as the Soviet Union breaks up. And those mill-to-mill engagements that had an environmental component, whether it was General Zinni in Combatant Command from Central Command saying, I need to talk to these new countries in Central Asia, I'm going to do natural disaster preparedness exchanges to figure out who's who and who's in charge and are the civilians in charge of the military and kind of basic security questions where environment was safe space. We tried that a couple times with China, and I would say, very limited success, but it hasn't been the context in the recent years at all. It's not even being tried, I'd say.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's worth a try. It's certainly going to be a point of contention going forward. So why can't it also be a point of collaboration? And I also think what's different, too, is that you know better than I do that the external context is shifting in that, you know, the environment as a means to an end, now the environment's going to start becoming the end. With the amount of environmental change and degradation going on, you know, I don't know when that starts to become more apparent to everyone. But, you know, yes, we can all keep going our nation state ways and trying to guarantee that we'll have what we need. And that'll be a pretty ugly world. But what I really hope is that that becomes a driver for cooperation. And I realize that's like, you know, for someone out of the defense world, that sounds awfully, you know, optimistic. But what choice do you have?
You know? But I don't think it's optimistic in that. And again, you will know far better than me. But my interactions with people in that traditional security world is their primary objective is to avoid fighting the war, to be prepared for it. But ideally, it's to avoid it. And that cooperation or exchange and understanding to avoid certainly accidental and ultimately to deter those who might want to do it otherwise, a lot of that is about communication, if not outright cooperation. Yeah. And so that's not the stretch that I think commonly is assumed, that it's all about use of force and total zero-sum game.
I think what worries me about that right now is that I don't think anybody's really, you know, what does a relationship with China look like that isn't on the road to war? And why aren't, you know, because we need to have a vision for how we can coexist. These two countries can actually thrive and coexist and also invest in what that looks like. And that's the other side of it. You know, that's a positive environmental engagement too. But right now, I'm not sure we as a country have a vision for what that is, right? We've gotten on a very adversarial road. And so how do we have a positive ending and how do we invest in that is a conversation I think we need to have in this country. I don't think the current administration is capable of that or interested in that. But it's also hard to say. I mean, today we're in a trade war. Tomorrow we may not be. but whoever the next president is, whenever that is, that person's going to have more than an opportunity. I think they're going to have a necessity to try to figure out, can we even have a vision for a world where the United States and China are not on a road to war? Where what does an end look like where we coexist? And it seems to me like, you know, the environment and particularly the mounting environmental degradation can play a part in either vision. You know, either it becomes a means of competing or even a weapon or a confidence building measure in an adversarial setting, or it becomes part of how we develop a more positive cooperative vision or at least make the investments towards what that would look like. I mean, I just think we're at a point where we should be investing as much effort and probably resources into a not war future with China as we are with a war future, because it'll be awful. Mm-hmm. If we really do, even if it's not a conventional shooting war, even if the cyber low intensity conflict that's already going on escalates, it's going to be so destructive, not just for the United States and China, but for everybody. So it's a war we can't afford, but we're not doing anything to avoid at the moment, in my opinion, other than sort of deterrence. But that's not much of a safe bet, I don't think. So, and I think environment should have a role, just like you said, as it did in the Cold War, but also has to because of what's happening in the biosphere.
Well, and that would be an ironic coda, right? Where the way that you find an alternative to conflict is to come back to the ultimate challenge of climate change, where the levels of interdependence and shared vulnerability can only be solved through true cooperation and fundamental change in both of those competing superpowers, and you need to bring everyone else along as well.
That would be an interesting irony, wouldn't it? I mean, that's one of the hypotheses that came out of the work that we were doing, is that once climate change starts affecting global agriculture, you know, there are already effects, but when it gets worse, you kind of need trade to be able to adjust. Like, at least the integrated assessment model we were working with suggests there will be enough capacity to grow enough food for the people in the world, even as the population grows. But the problem is the patterns of where it's being grown are going to shift. So if you don't have the ability to adjust, people are going to suffer more everywhere. So it seems like that's one of the answers there, is that it's in all of our interests, a mutual interest, to not lock in bilateral offtake agreements, because they won't be good enough to compensate. You need to be able to float with where the growing is improving and when, and, you know, because it's not clear that that's going to be a stately process, that, you know, this place is slowly not, you know, going fallow, and this place is slowly, you know, Canada's peat is suddenly, you know, productive. It's not going to be like that. I think things are going to come and go, and you're going to need to be able to adjust. So yeah, it would be kind of a sweet irony if at the end of the day, climate change creates a really powerful need for collaboration and cooperation.
There's our alternative path. Climate change will solve the problem.
You've been listening to Friday Podcast from the Environmental Change and Security Program. For more information, follow us on Twitter @NewSecurityBeat and visit newsecuritybeat.org.